This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
You know how you always want to know about everyone else's money? Well, then listen to What We Spend, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cody Benjamin covers the NFL for CBS Sports. You can follow him on X on Twitter, at Cody J. Benjamin. Cody is on with us because I read Cody's column yesterday ranking the quarterbacks, the projected starting quarterbacks in the NFL, 1 through 32 post-draft. And his number one quarterback in the NFL, Jaden Daniels. So, Cody, how'd you arrive at Jaden at number one?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. You know, it's funny, we get some lulls in the NFL offseason, not many, but there are some where you don't hear a lot. I mean, there's not a ton of chatter. As soon as any quarterback power ranking goes out, emails, Twitter posts, people will even find me on LinkedIn to criticize whatever order they don't like. But with Jaden Daniels, I mean, everyone knows, I guess, you know, how magical the rookie season was. And these rankings are always a combination. It's not an exact – it's a tricky science. You know, you're trying to weigh current status with future outlook, with, you know, past experience. And I just have a hard time, you know, right now as we stand going into 2025, is Patrick Mahomes more reliable? Sure. Did Jalen Hurts just win a Super Bowl? Absolutely. You know, would I maybe rather take Joe Burrow as a pure pocket passer? Maybe, yeah. But I think you just look at the entire quarterback landscape. I think it's hard to find a quarterback who has as much promise, as much foundational support. You look at what Washington did to help him this offseason. And yes, we just saw a few, you know, last year, C.J. Stroud endured a certain sophomore slump. Daniels might not be immune to that. But right now, as we stand, I just think it's hard to find a guy who's drawing more, who's shown much, you know, more promise than he has. And I just think that the bar is set so high for him this year. People want him to he was on the doorstep of a Super Bowl in year one. And so I don't see it as that outrageous.
Yeah, not only was he, you know, 60 minutes away from the Super Bowl, the reason they were 60 minutes away from the Super Bowl was him more than anything else. I mean, you'd have to count 12 spots to get to whatever number two was after him. You're right, by the way. This is what I always refer to as, you know, power rankings and list season, which, you know, a lot of that sparks a lot of fun conversation. Something you wrote that I actually wanted, I thought it was an interesting way that you put it. You wrote, you'd be hard pressed to find an NFL team that wouldn't hurry to claim him as its quarterback of the present and future, contenders included. So let's play this game. What teams in the NFL wouldn't swap quarterbacks?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, because again, with these rankings, it's you're trying to kind of play both sides where it's very hard to separate these quarterbacks from their situations, right? I mean, would Jared Goff be in the top 10 if he didn't have Detroit set up? If he was with, for example, I'm just trying to think of a bottom of the barrel. If he were with the Colts or You know, the Browns. You know, I don't think Jared Goff would be in the top 10 probably. And so you're looking at there's a very select few, and I think you probably see it in the top six there. So on that list, we've got in the top six, Jaden Daniels, Jalen Hurts, Joe Burrow, Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes. I mean, those are the names where I think it would be, you know, those teams, you could see it either way. You know, the Eagles, look, you know, Jalen Hurts deserves a lot of respect for, he did take a back seat for the Eagles Super Bowl run, but he answered the, you know, when he was needed, he answered. And so I don't think you can take anything away from Jalen Hurts. And Eagles fans wouldn't admit this probably after a Super Bowl win. But if you were the Eagles and you could keep everything else about the Eagles, but you could swap in Jaden Daniels for Jalen Hurts, a younger quarterback, a little more spry quarterback, a guy who has shown equal probably amount of poise at the NFL level, granted on a small sample size, I just think even that could be – you could make a case where the Eagles, if you put truth serum in their drinks, they might say, yeah, we like, if we had our choice for the long term, we might rather take Jaden Daniels. And I don't think that's crazy. Again, if after three more years, we've seen a stark regression from Jaden Daniels, well, then the rankings will reflect that. But right now, I just think, yeah, maybe Burrow, Hurts, Jackson, Allen, Mahomes, those are kind of the only guys that I think would probably stand a chance in that kind of a scenario.
I think the Eagles is a no-brainer. I mean, by the way, I would imagine that some of the critique was having Jalen Hurts number two, because that was the surprise for me, although you wrote something that I totally agree with, and that is his instincts, toughness, downfield touch, rugged mobility all show up in the clutch. That is an absolute truth with Jalen Hurts. He has played his best football in the biggest games that he's been involved in. Go back to the Super Bowl that they lost to the Chiefs. He may have been the best player on the field in that game. Yeah. But I looked at it this way. I think there are two quarterbacks and two quarterback situations in the NFL that, without question, teams would never decide to swap with Washington. I think Kansas City and Buffalo, Mahomes and Allen. I look at Burrow and I think they wouldn't want to do it, but his injury history might make them consider it. I look at Lamar, Cody, and I'm like, I don't know that they'd want to do it, but his postseason, you know, up and down, to say it kindly, might be, you know, a concern moving forward. By the way, some of his injury history as well. Jaden just had the most amazing season and, by the way, played his best in their biggest games. I'm not sure that any team wouldn't seriously consider it, with the exception of Kansas City and Buffalo.
Yeah, and I think you hit on it a little bit that, you know, with some of these guys, you can pick and choose. You go down the list of starting quarterbacks. Some guys get their ranking because of trustworthiness. Some guys get it because of just physical gifts. You know, I think of like a Justin Herbert, where I can never quite, you know, bring myself to drop him out of the top 15 just because the numbers always look pretty good. You know, he just came off a year where he threw three picks. He's the total physical package. But yet he has no, like, you would clearly, like, already after 1 year, you clearly would give Jaden Daniels the advantage in terms of, this guy's just unflappable. Like, in high-pressure moments, you already trust that. And so some guys have the gifts. Some guys have that it factor. Jaden Daniels, again, 1 year, you know, we that's the preface, but he has both. And so with Lamar, you know, Lamar has been great. He has the gifts. He's shown it year after year. But that it factor, when it counts, is still an asterisk with him.
No doubt.
You know, maybe that just is a product of playing in the same conference as Patrick Mahomes. But guess what? Jaden Daniels played in the same conference as Jalen Hurts last year, as, you know, Matthew Stafford at whatever. And he ended up, like you said, close to the Super Bowl. So, yeah, I think Washington fans should just – this is the time to relish it. I mean, until Jaden Daniels shows us otherwise, and that may be – well, he's up there.
Yeah, I think your point, you know, about it's just 1 year, actually works for the question, right? Like, would you swap? Because there's so much that is unrealized, and what you saw in 1 year was so unusual. Like, you know, we've talked about this since the season ended, where, you know, people have said, well, look out, look at C.J. Stroud's sophomore slump year. And I'm like, the two aren't even comparable. C.J. Stroud's rookie year was a distant second to Jaden's rookie year. Like, it's hard to envision him improving or needing to improve in areas. And this isn't just Homer talk. It's just true. Like, there isn't anything he did last year where you're like, if he were to improve next year, you would say, oh, thank God he improved that. Like, because he wasn't any good at doing that last year. It's hard to come up with it. You know, they've mentioned things like footwork and decision making, but yeah, it would be as much about the unrealized based on what they think he might become, which might make some teams, you know, a Cincinnati or, you know, a Green Bay with a Jordan Love, like lots of potential, but say, yeah, but this guy's going to be better. I think it's an interesting way to look at it. But so where was the pushback primarily from people on your list?
Oh, I mean, you name it. Not many. You never get the "I love this list" comment. You know, never.
You mean so Washington fans weren't thrilled?
Oh, sure. I mean, but I still think it's much easier to yell loudly about something you're unhappy about. So yeah. I think, you know, always with the rookies and, you know, guys who haven't played a down like J.J. McCarthy. I mean, you know, that's going to get some pushback because. Yes, we could just throw Cam Ward at 32 because he's never played. But I just, you know, again, it's kind of that as we sit here right now, would I rather bet on the unknown of Cam Ward or the known of Joe Flacco? Like, I'm going to take Cam Ward in that scenario. And so there's a little pushback about having, you know, J.J. McCarthy ahead of Bryce Young. I think the Burrow, the Lamar, there's a constant debate amongst, you know, the Ravens, Bills, Bengals fans about how those three kind of stack up. And even though at the end of the day, they all fall short to Mahomes when it counts, I think there's constantly some bickering kind of about, well, you know, Lamar should be ahead of Burrow. He beat him in the regular season and all that. So in my mind, yes, obviously these rankings are meant to, you know, get people talking about where they rank. But to me, the more important thing is not so much the actual number, like you're one or you're three or you're seven. It's what group are you in? Are you in the top 10 there? Are you, because, you know, Jaden Daniels, Hurts, like those are the guys you just know are the upper echelon there. Where if you're between 17 and 25, so many of those guys are interchangeable. And so, I think any city who wasn't number one is pushing back.
You know, I think we have these conversations every year, you know, sometimes during the season, you know, the quarterback tiers or, you know, the rankings. And, you know, I think there have been years recently where the list has been much deeper, but we had a lot of retirements, whether it was, you know, Brady or Rivers or, you know, Breeze. You know, in the last 5-6 years, we've had some retirements of all-time greats. We've had Aaron Rodgers kind of take a step back. I'll ask you about that in a moment. But I think that now the conversation of like the top five or six is like, you know, I think you, I don't know that I actually think Jalen Hurts at times is very underrated. I don't know that I'd put him in that elite category, but I think, you know, Mahomes and Allen and Jackson and Burrow and Jaden are in that category. And then it's like there's a lot of in the next 10. You know, there you could go with almost anything. I think so. I think the position. I guess the question, because I'm just rambling here. The question is, do you think the position is deep compared to previous years?
Well, I think that you're onto something with. There is that group of guys that are they're kind of just transcendent talents, and it's very hard to find them. Everyone's trying. Right. But you know, the Jaden Daniels, the guys who just can do things that not others can do and, are probably going to elevate any team they're on. And even that's only to a degree because I put in Joe Burrow's blurb, you know, the last 2 years of his starts, they're just 14-13. And right. So that's a top three quarterback, according to that ranking. And yet, you know, we should see with the Eagles run this last year, too, that you could even have an elite quarterback, whatever you want to call Jalen Hurts, a really good quarterback, a championship, you know, a clutch quarterback. You could have that. But, what you know, I think that we've also seen in the Joe Burrow record, in the Super Bowl run by the Eagles, it isn't always all about the quarterback either. Like, we love to have these conversations. It's much easier path to a Super Bowl win with an elite quarterback, a transcendent talent. But you also, like, it's a team sport. We have to always remind ourselves of that every single year. So much of this comes down to supporting cast. Look at those top teams, Washington, Philadelphia on the quarterback rankings list, Cincy, Baltimore, Buffalo, Kansas City, the Rams, the Packers. I mean, most of those teams have playoff caliber supporting cast, playoff caliber head coaches. So that it's obviously a package deal. As far as, you know, you're saying, is it deeper? I just think it's kind of a pick your poison. What kind of a quarterback do you want? You know, after that first tier, you know, Jared Goff, he's not going to move with his legs. If you prefer a pure old school pocket passer, that's your guy. Brock Purdy, if you want a point guard who can move a little bit more, that's him. Baker Mayfield, you want a quarterback who's going to truck a linebacker in the open field? That's your guy. I think it's kind of a pick your poison in terms of who matches well with your coordinator, with your talent, with the direction of your team.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way you're thinking about it, because we've had so many of these same conversations. You know, like, you can look at, okay, the Super Bowl winners, you know, other than Foles, you know, it's been Brady, it's been Mahomes, you had Stafford, who was an elite quarterback, certainly that year. And then, you know, you can debate Jalen Hurts. But I think what I've kind of settled on, Cody, in recent years is that having that truly elite, transcendent, you know, however you want to describe, top five-ish kind of a quarterback, the thing that it guarantees more than anything else isn't necessarily a Super Bowl. It just guarantees that as long as that player's upright and healthy, you are going to be a sustained contender year in and year out. You know, even Cincinnati, you look at the Burrow thing, they didn't make the postseason last year. They were still a 9-8 football team. Like, with elite quarterback play, you are in contention to make it to the postseason, to win more games than you lose. And that's the best way to get into that position more than any other way.
Yes. And I think, you know, this conversation is very nuanced, because you also, right, like, you want that kind of a quarterback, but you also don't want to throw him into Cleveland, for example. I mean, that's just not going to be great for their development. They're not going to have the weapons they need, the coaching perhaps. But yes, I think you're also highlighting, let's acknowledge first, it's a team sport. You need more than the quarterback. But now, when it comes to the quarterback position, when it comes to deciding, are we going to extend this guy or are we going to reset? A lot of teams, you look at the middle of this group, guys like Geno Smith, you know, Dak Prescott, you know, your Kirk Cousins of previous years, maybe Tua, Sam Darnold, these guys that just float in the middle. With those organizations that are paying those guys, they're in that weird space of, yeah, would it have been better to just basically risk our job security, say, we're not going to pay big money to this. We're going to, you know, try and tear it down. I mean, sometimes you look at these teams that hit, you know, Washington, the Eagles, even when they drafted Jalen Hurts, they still had Carson Wentz. I mean, and they had to rebuild the whole thing. Now I'm rambling, but what I mean is that sometimes it's better to take the lumps and restart that you know, swing at quarterback rather than just keep settling. You know, I think of like Derek Carr with the Saints, to a degree, yeah, the Cowboys, like these teams that they get content with just hovering around the wild card picture. And in a way, it kind of keeps the fans engaged because you're always kind of in the mix. But no one really believes that those guys are talented enough to really take you over the top. And so it's a tough business to get it right.
That's such, you know, and you brought up somebody who my listeners know that I know well and I'm a fan of, but you're right in that, you know, what Minnesota did with Cousins all those years, paying him elite money, prevented them from putting a really good, consistent, deep team around him. Now, I don't think he was middle of the pack. I think he was closer to kind of top 10, but he was not elite. He wasn't, you know, Burrow. He wasn't Josh Allen. He wasn't Mahomes. He wasn't Jaden Daniels. And that's a decision that teams have to make. And look, the great thing that Washington's involved in now is, A, they know they have a guy that they will be willingly pay, but they don't have to do it yet. You know, this may be the ultimate rookie contract situation in NFL history, to have somebody appear to be elite this quickly. Like, I don't know that Mahomes, clearly in year two, we know what he looked like. But I don't think anybody's ever looked this good this quickly where you're sure you got him. You got the right guy.
Yeah, because you're right. Mahomes was year two. Even like Josh Allen.
Right.
That was,
took a couple years.
Yeah, we're talking like 3 years in before he looked like worthy of a contract. Burrow had a big injury. I think it is the most ideal where you hit the ball out of the park immediately with the rookie deal. And it looked that way for C.J. Stroud in Houston, and that's kind of when they went all in. I guess you could say all in. They added Stephon Diggs last offseason. It looked as if they were making all the right moves. Unfortunately, the injuries took their toll out wide. The trenches didn't hold up, and he regressed. But yeah, I think in Minnesota's case, you mentioned with Kirk Cousins, by the time they had actually poured enough resources into building up that supporting cast with Justin Jefferson, Jordan Addison, well, now he's past his mid 30s, tears his Achilles. It's too late. You had to move on. You had to say, okay, we can't keep settling for this good enough. We can't. We have to roll the dice, take a flyer on a free agent, take a flyer on moving up and drafting a quarterback. And so, now they're hoping, obviously, they can hit with McCarthy.
Yeah. This is my nature when it comes to him. When he tore his Achilles, I think that was the best football he had played in his career and on the best team in supporting cast because they finally had a defense. But we'll move on from him. So I am curious as to, we're talking to Cody Benjamin, by the way, from CBS Sports. Go read his top 32 quarterback power rankings where he's got Jaden number one. There are some major question marks here, not necessarily with contenders, but what is going to happen in Pittsburgh? Is Aaron Rodgers going to sign there or not?
Well, they sure hope so. Publicly, they have put themselves in such a corner. This is the polar opposite of last offseason when the Steelers, historically over the last few decades, they're not offseason, free agent trade. They don't make splashes there. And last offseason, I was surprised even how proactive they were in resetting the quarterback room, trading Kenny Pickett after just a couple years. Add Russ, add Justin Fields. Those were cheap moves, but they were moves. This offseason, it's sit on our hands and, pretend Mason Rudolph is going to be taking over for, as Mike Tomlin enters this, I don't know that he's actually under pressure by the front office, but from the fans, certainly. To be sitting here in, almost mid-May, and we've got Mason Rudolph, a sixth-round rookie at quarterback, to me, the Steelers may pretend that this is some – maybe they do have something crazy up their sleeve. I doubt it. To me, it reads more like an accidental mishap here. And so it's kind of you're putting all your chips – on a 41-year-old Aaron Rodgers who may or may not be all in on playing football. And so maybe he still shows up. I have a hard time believing they had those conversations and didn't get some inclination about what he's going to do, because otherwise, what are you doing,
Yeah, I read something recently that everybody in the building just loves Mason Rudolph. Well, everybody in the building loved Taylor Heineke,
Yeah, exactly.
That's essentially the equivalent. Rudolph's played better, more consistently, and had, I think, more starts. I don't know if that's true or not. It feels like it is. But they can't win with Mason Rudolph. It has to be Rodgers. I
mean, that's a talking point you'll hear from any team about any guy who's just plugged in as the de facto starter in May. I mean, come October 12th, you know, if you're sitting under 500 and the picks are, you know, you're throwing as many picks as touchdowns.
Yeah.
I mean, does everyone love Mason Rudolph in the building then? I mean, I'm not, you know, no discredit to his character or whatever. I mean, he showed he was the most competent of their quarterbacks a few years ago, but that's not a high bar. I think they have to say that because, well, you trade for DK Metcalf, you bring Mike Tomlin back, you know, you make these moves as if you're going to be something this year. No one else is on the roster. What, you know, what else are they going to imagine if they said, we don't like Mason Rudolph, you know?
Point taken. What about New York? Do you think they moved up and back into the first round to select Jackson Dart because Brian Daboll thinks there's a chance he could start day one?
I would be surprised. I mean, I think, yes, Brian Daboll, I think it's been reported and it seems pretty clear that he was the driving force for that decision. And stylistically, it makes sense. If you look at Jackson Dart, you just throw on some highlights. You know, I see some just from the physical build and the way he moves and throws. I see some Jalen Hurts, you know, some shades of that style. And that makes sense for Brian Daboll. Remember his best year with the Giants, he kind of turned Daniel Jones into a guy who just kind of moved and protected the ball, which is what Jalen Hurts did, you know, for the Eagles. And so as far as day one, though, you know, I think there's still enough pressure to win this year that you try and squeeze whatever juice is left out of Russell Wilson, because theoretically, even though he can't move as well, you know, the ability previously to roll out, take a shot deep, get neighbors involved, I still think it's Russ. Unless we get another random August calf injury, then maybe you do put Dart in instead of Jameis Winston.
Really good job. I really appreciate the conversation. Go read Cody. He just put a list of the top 10 wide receiver duos out, but you can follow him and read all of his stuff by going to his Twitter X account, Cody J. Benjamin. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, no problem. I'll have to keep ranking the Commanders number one, and then we have some fun conversations then.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get into this wide receiver list probably tomorrow, but thanks, Cody. Okay.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Yeah, list and ranking season for sure. Tim Legler is going to jump on the show. We'll talk some NBA playoffs with Legs next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
All right, the Boston Celtics blew another 20-point lead to the New York Knicks last night to lose 91-90. They go up 2-0, or the Celtics go down 2-0 in the series, heading to MSG. That is sure to be an exciting night. Speaking of blown leads, the Washington Nationals blew yet another one. Up 3-0 heading into the sixth, Michael Soroka loads the bases and gives up three RBIs to tie the game. Jorge Lopez entered in relief and gave up two more runs to put the Nats down 5-3. Andrew Chafin tried to finish off the inning, tried his best, might I add, and ended up with three more on the board. The Nats go down 8-3 and finish down 8-6. They got the Cardinals coming to town. They will play tomorrow. Nats on deck with Charlie and Dave starts at 6:15 on the Fan. Tonight on 106.7, the Caps will take on the Canes in Game 2. Spencer Carberry said expect lineup changes following a dreadful performance in Game 1. Taylor Radish expected to get the draw in for Ryan Leonard. Ryan Leonard took extra time with the scratches tonight after practice. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1, and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
They're going to go. They're not going to use the timeout. Plenty of time here.
It's Tatum. Robinson's on him. Tatum maneuvering. Oh, the ball knocked away. Another great defensive play for the Knicks. They've got it. They've won it. New York has gone up wins again at the end.
Back-to-back 20-point leads blown. Knicks lead 2-0. Do they have to win Game 3? I kind of feel like they need to win on Saturday. Joining me right now, my friend Tim Legler. By the way, what's your next game? Do you have one of the games on Friday night?
I do not. I've got two games out in San Francisco, Saturday and Monday, Games 3 and 4 of the Minnesota Golden State Series.
With no Steph. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I played your sound yesterday about the way you felt about Game 1 in the Boston-New York series, called it an abomination, the way they played. What'd you think of last night?
Yeah, so look, I actually thought that the beginning of the game, it was clear to me their intent was to get into the paint, more particularly Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum. I thought both of those guys had a different approach. Derek White was probably the only guy that looked similar. You know, he's going to look, he's got a very quick release. He's a high percentage 3-point shooter. He's going to look for him. So I don't think he changed much, but I thought the other two guys looked different at the start of the game. And they weren't making threes, the ones that they did take, but I was happy as just an analyst watching them have better balance in their offense and not taking the very first open look they got. And they built a lead that way. Their defense was excellent. I was prepared to go on SVP after the game, and all the notes I was taking was leading me to a possession of them defensively, because I thought I saw some great things out of them there, and then a possession of turning down a three that led to something better in the paint. Like, this was going to be my two-play touchscreen. I took over 20 pages of notes on this game. And then all of a sudden, Kevin, here we go. And it wasn't like they started just completely, you know, taking threes the way they did in Game 1 that opened the door for the Knicks, because that's exactly what they did. By extending the game, they created more possessions in that game because of how quickly they were shooting the ball.
Right.
And the Knicks needed all of that. That's not what happened last night. Last night, they only took three or four during that entire stretch when they were erasing that lead. They were getting into the paint. They were shooting mid-rangers. They had a couple plays at the rim. They just looked incredibly tight to me in everything that they were doing. So they were not able to convert, to stop the momentum. It only takes a basket or two, and they win the game in about a five-minute stretch. It was going to take two baskets probably to win the game, and they couldn't get it done. And I think the environment in the building for a home team in that situation, the shock that was probably being projected onto the court from the fans, I think it affected some of those guys. I think Tatum was affected by the narrative over the last 48 hours about all the threes they were taking, all the threes he was taking. I don't remember him hunting a single step back three in the entire game. He only took five for the night, and he takes 10 on average. And so I think he was really going overboard to try to prove to people that, like, he wasn't going to continue to go into this trap of just settling for 3-point shots. And I think his mind was fried the entire night. That's what I think. And then in the fourth quarter, the pressure of the moment really just engulfed that entire team, where they couldn't operate normally offensively. And the Knicks smelled it, tasted it, and they were able to do the exact same thing they did to him in Game 1 and flip the script in a period of about 8 minutes.
Yeah, I described it as like the yips. I mean, it really looked like it. He that corner three that he had, he took his time and almost aimed it. You know, that's not the way shooters shoot it. You know, what's interesting about the way you described Game 1 versus Game 2. Game 1, like, would you have had an issue had they just not taken the volume of threes so quickly with the lead? If they had ultimately shortened the game, which I totally agree with you, they didn't do, and it's still, you know, shot, and they wouldn't have shot as many because there would have been fewer possessions, because it is kind of the way they play. Yeah. To a certain degree, it was just different in Game 1 because of how quickly they went.
No, that's really what the problem was, and people, you know, that heard my critique, I hope that's what they took from it, because that's what I was talking about. When I said it was insulting to the game of basketball, that's really what I meant. You know, the basketball gods are looking at them and like saying, you played a great game, you got a 20-point lead. Well, then the way basketball works, you don't like completely change your identity. It's not like you come up the floor and throw the ball into Al Horford in the post for the next 8 minutes. That's clearly not what they're going to do. This is their style. I get it. They've got a lot of guys that can shoot it. What I'm saying is, why were they taking shots that quickly off of one pass. Or I had examples written down, and you know, the funny thing is, it wasn't just Tatum, although he probably took five or six off the dribble step back threes without anybody else touching the ball in that possession. I was actually more concerned with the couple of the ones Horford took, a couple of the ones Drew Holiday took. Drew Holiday ran down a long rebound in the corner, right in front of the bench,
and just fired it up.
The opposing bench, and turned and fired a three with a guy draped on him, as if it was the last play of the game and they were down by two. That's literally what it looked like, and it was almost. I made a joke last night. It almost got to the point. It looked like whoever makes one first wins a car. Like, that's what it looked like. Yeah. There was some sort of competition going on. That's how quick they were just letting them fly. Single crack of daylight, I'm letting it fly. And of course, according to Second Spectrum, which I have a lot of problems with, some of those are labeled uncontested. I would probably differ in that opinion. But the one thing that is not disputable is you can have a shot that's rushed, even if it's uncontested. And they did that repeatedly, 37 threes after halftime. I mean, you've got to be kidding me. In a game you're controlling. So my problem wasn't necessarily the sheer volume, because they could have gotten threes at the end of those possessions too.
Right.
If once the ball hit the paint and then kicked out, and they you know, they go around the horn a little bit. Like, that's when they're at their best, and you can't catch up to the ball. And they have too many guys that can shoot it, and that's when they just bury teams. But when they come down and there's this shell that's never penetrated on the perimeter before they shoot the ball, when you're up 20, no, I think that is insulting to the game of basketball, because that's not how you win games. And that was my big problem with them. I don't think that was as much a problem in game two. They were actually, I think, thinking about it a little bit more. They still took 40, which is seven below their season average. It's going to still put them probably in the top 10 teams in the league in the regular season. So it's still a good number of threes. But to me, this was all about the pressure of the moment completely paralyzing them. And I mean, that goes all the way from the players through the coaching staff, everything. And that's, I think, why Mazzulla didn't take that timeout at the end of the game, which is inexplicable to me, because I think he might have even felt the pressure and not knowing what to draw up. So let's just let him play. Let the players solve it. On a night when you're that bad offensively, Kevin, you can't walk home with a timeout in your pocket when you're taking your keys out and you're emptying your keys on your nightstand. Oh, there's a timeout in here. No, you can't do that. Not on a night they're that bad offensively. They needed you to take that off their plate and figure out something, inbounding the ball from half court with 12 seconds to go, that can potentially create the switch you want, create some sort of spacing to allow a guy maybe to get downhill in a one-point game, instead of just saying, oh, I'm just going to trust Jason Tatum because the last time we ran this, he got a dunk. So let's just go to it again.
That's what that had to be what he was thinking, because when he didn't call the timeout, I think he was just thinking he could go coast to coast. That was just a defensive breakdown on the possession before, and they were ready for it with two players ready to stop the penetration when he got down there.
Well, listen, I was already very interested in that last sequence, right? Going into the post game with Scott last night. And then I became extremely interested as I'm sitting there listening to his post game presser, Mazzulla, because he said exactly verbatim. He said, the first question, well, any consideration of taking a timeout right there? And he said, well, you know, we just got a great action off the last time we ran it, so we're just going to run it again. You know, I was hoping to get the same thing. And they covered it differently. Yeah, no kidding. The first time was an uncontested dunk by Tatum, which was really crazy to think a guy could go coast to coast and dunk the ball without being touched.
On that kind of a possession, yeah.
Yeah, it was a possession that important.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is there's still 20-something seconds left, 24 seconds left in the game when he did that. Okay, so the Knicks have plenty of time to respond to that. This last one, you're taking it out with 12 seconds. You really think the Knicks are going to let you do that again? No, they're going to lose the game if that happens. So he just should have, to me, anticipated some was going to be different, and the big difference was on the first one, Ananobi picked him up 75 feet up the floor, which allowed Horford to set that brush screen at half court. They got Ananobi off of him, and now Tatum's going 100 miles an hour at Mitchell Robinson, who's 35 feet from the basket. Yeah, he can blow right by him. The second time, as Tatum's coming up the floor, there's nobody in the picture. Like, everybody is back, and you could, I even froze it on the touchscreen. I did. Horford is trying to screen, and literally he's sandwiched up on one side Ananobi, on one side Robinson, but they're right at the 3-point line. So I stopped it and froze it as Tatum's crossing half court. There's still 9.8 seconds left, and Mazzulla's standing right up there by half court, right near an official. Like,
could have called the timeout there.
If that's what you thought it was going to look like, and you said that in your post-game presser, I got news for you. You should have identified as he's crossing half court. It doesn't look like that at all. Now, it's all kinds of traffic in there. Tatum has had a terrible night offensively. Maybe I should take a timeout right here. And we still have 9.5 seconds to run something constructive out of bounds. Kevin, think about this. How many times, honestly, do you watch games in the NBA, and at the end of a game, a star player, which both of those guys are, don't even get off either a shot attempt or a pass? It happened twice in a row to them. Jaylen Brown got the ball ripped out of his hands by Bridges in the first game, and last night Tatum jumps in the air. He's swallowed up by two guys jumping at him. Brown is wide open on the wing, but Tatum had already committed to the shot, tries to throw a pass in the air, gets stolen. It's just so rare to see a star player not even get a desperation shot up on the backboard or make a pass to another guy and hopefully they can make a shot. They didn't even get a shot off in two game-winning situations in the playoffs. It's really
the time left on the inbounds in overtime in game one was a lot less time. I think it was less than 3 seconds.
No, you're right.
But I totally agree with you. A guy
would get it up somehow. Like, I'm just, that's my point though. Like,
right,
on that flare pass they threw to Brown.
Exactly. You
know, normally they're gonna somehow, some way, they're going to get some desperation heave up at the rim. I mean, he just got the ball ripped right out of his hands. And then last night, of course, Tatum gets in the air and throws it away. And I froze it because I wanted to see how much time was left when Bridges made contact with the ball. It was over 3 seconds.
Yeah.
So you had Brown all alone on the wing. If somehow you can get that ball out of that to him, now who knows what happens, because he didn't have a very good night either, especially the second half. You know, he either shoots a three or maybe he takes a one dribble pull up 18 footer, but he's getting that shot off. But Tatum could not get the ball to him. And now here we go, man. We're sitting here. We just saw history. No team's ever blown 220 point leads in a row in the playoffs. No team's ever come back from 220 point leads. So I want to get
to some of the other series, but real quickly on this one, I said earlier in the show, it ain't over yet. I mean, I don't feel like it is. And I think game three is really important for the Knicks to win. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. Totally. I agree with both of those statements. I don't think it's over. And I do think if the Knicks lose game three, particularly what I think the Celtics would have to look like to win that game, it would mean that they got back on track offensively. And they probably had some guys play well in the fourth quarter, because I don't think they're blowing the Knicks out. I think it's going to be a close game. If they win a close game and you got Tatum or Brown play well, or their team play well when they need to, they're going to feel like an absolute brand new team going into game four. So now you've got a real fight on your hands if you're the Knicks. Look, they've taken control. How much more control can you take winning two games on the road to start the series? I agree, it's not over. And I do think if the Knicks are going to get the Celtics' best game to this point in game three, sometimes when you can get away from the noise of your home crowd and the anxiety that's in the building in a tight situation like this, it might be the best thing for them to go play on the road and feel like an us against the world mentality, rather than at home where every time somebody misses a three right now, there's a groan, a collective groan from 20,000 people. Everybody feels it. On the road, you're not going to feel that. So I think it's the best thing that can happen to them. Go play in the Garden. It's going to be a wild, wild environment on Saturday afternoon. And the Knicks have a chance to absolutely put a stranglehold on this thing. If they lose, you're back into a situation, I think, headed for a very long series and potentially a game seven on the road.
All right. Let's shift out west. Do the Warriors up 1-0 in this series with Minnesota without Steph for at least, I think, the next two minimum, maybe three games? Does Golden State have a chance to win this series without Steph for three games?
That'd be, I think, unlikely to think they're going to win it. I think they'll hang. And I think I was thinking about it today. Well, what could be likely is win a game while he's out, down 3-2, coming back to San Francisco for game six, Steph emerges. I think that's the shortest timeline for him. And I think that's probably the situation they would be in. I think they can get one. I don't know if they can get more than that.
And I would certainly, if they got it to a seventh and deciding game with Steph healthy, I would give the Warriors a major chance.
I agree with that because they've managed those situations incredibly well. They've just managed one in the previous round. A couple of years ago, they went and won a game seven on the road against Sacramento in the first round. So they're used to that environment, and they've got, I think, guys that will step up and do what they have to do in that moment to make plays. The question is, their defense will keep him in it, I believe, over the next two, three games, whenever he's out. Can those other guys score enough without Curry on the floor? Because he creates so many opportunities for those role players because of his presence. You know, the Moses Moody's and the Pajemskis and the Buddy Hields of the world. What do those guys do against a very good defense to create their own offense? That's the big question.
You know what? I'm curious. I want to get to Denver, the Denver OKC series as well. But I thought Kerr the other night, the use of his bench after Steph was out, going as deep into places of his bench like Pat Spencer that he hadn't gone to, was fascinating. Were you able to make sense of it? It worked, but describe it from your standpoint.
Yeah, he didn't have a choice. I don't think I've ever seen a coaching staff more pressed as they're standing there watching that game thinking, please, one basket. Somebody give me one basket. And yeah. Buddy Hield actually was the guy that hit the biggest shot. He hit a corner three when that lead got down to 10. And it cut it in half, basically. And Buddy Hield hit a corner three. And I thought that was the biggest shot. You could almost see this collective sigh of relief when that ball went through. And so now they're thinking, okay, we're going to be able to hold on. Everybody looked more relaxed after that.
Denver wins game one. I've watched now all of Oklahoma City's postseason games. I think they're the best team, but they don't have the experience. But what do you think? Are they the best team, and will they win it all?
Well, I think Oklahoma City's been the best team in the league this year, the best team I've seen. Has played their best basketball. Oklahoma City's the best. Now, this is only their second time kind of going through this on this level. So they didn't handle it very well last year. Let's see how they handle it this year. But I do think now, particularly with the way Boston looks, Cleveland is obviously hanging on by a thread with all their injuries, down 0-2, going on the road. I think Oklahoma City is firmly in the
driver's seat now.
All right, you're jumping into your rental car or your car. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it. Good luck on the next two out in San Francisco. You're great on the broadcast. All right, talk to you. Tim Legler, everybody, calling in from wherever he was getting off a plane and getting into a car. Nice of him to do that. He's got the Warriors' next two games on Saturday night on ABC against Minnesota, and then on Monday night on ESPN against Minnesota as well. After tonight. Tonight is game two of that series. All right, that's it for the day. Caps tonight, back tomorrow.